Good afternoon and welcome to the White House. It was so nice to get to spend some time with many of you yesterday evening at the event. Big thanks to the Walton Foundation for that event that brought everybody together to really celebrate chefs and their work and sustainable fishing. So great introduction and celebration of all the champs last night, and then today we will get down to the real meat of celebrating what works and communicating that across the country. I am so excited to be here to celebrate our outstanding champions of change who are leading the way in ensuring that the United States is a global leader in sustainable seafood. It's our local leaders just like all of you and the champions we're celebrating today, who are making a difference in their communities and helping the continued revitalization of America's fishing industry. And you may know that today, this month, is National Seafood Month, so there's no better time for us to be having this event and coming together to talk about this success. Our fishing industry is critical to the economic health and well-being of communities across the country and around the globe, for that matter. We have made huge strides over the past 10 years in building sustainability while at the same time growing the industry. Here in the United States, nearly 5 billion pounds of seafood are consumed each year, and in 2014, the seafood industry contributed $214 billion to the American economy and supported more than 1.8 million jobs. Yet ocean warming and acidification and other impacts of climate change are putting the industry and the local economies that depend on it at risk. As we increasingly experience these impacts, it is important more than ever for us to invest in sustainable fishing and support the fishermen, businesses, and innovators that are leading the way in this industry. One place where fishermen are seeing the impacts of climate change every day is New England, where fishing plays a unique role in the region's economy and the very culture of that region of this country. According to a NOAA ocean temperatures study, in the Northeast, the waters are projected to warm close to 3 times faster than the global average, impacting a majority of fish species in the region, including lobster, shrimp, scallops, and other regularly seen seafood across the country. These changes are real and they're happening now, threatening the future of businesses and marine life that the region depends upon. I'm sure this story is familiar to many of you out here, but it's increasingly true and very true for Chris Brown, one of today's awardees, who has been a commercial fisherman in Rhode Island for over 38 years. Experiencing these impacts firsthand inspired Chris to become a tireless advocate for implementing new sustainable fishing measures. In 2010, Brown was one of the New England commercial fishermen who collaborated on a catch share program to set a sustainable limit on species allowed to be caught per year, providing incentives for fishermen while also ensuring fish populations have time to rebuild. Through accountability and traceability in the company's supply chain, Chris is setting a new standard of sustainability throughout the industry. So thank you to Chris. Though we've made great strides in our ocean policy, there's still a lot of work to be done. Our champions understand these problems better than anyone and are already adapting to the sustainable measures that our communities need in unique and innovative ways. Take, for example, also Champ Alan Lovewell, who owns a community-supported fishery in Northern California, which provides weekly deliveries of high-quality, sustainable seafood to that area. This unique business model helps connect consumers directly to their local fishermen while also maximizing the use of local fish species without overfishing. This company has also launched a new program, Bay to Tray, that provides local seafood to public school children through their school lunches and brings local fishermen into their classrooms to teach them about ocean health. Now, as someone who has 2 little children, my son who is 6, his favorite dinner is any kind of white fish. So if we could get that white fish here in the DC school system, that would be really incredible because their lunches, as far as I can tell, have no fish. So in conclusion, let me say to all of our champions here today, you are remarkable. And this Champions of Change event that we've had now, several of these, you will be the last of the Obama administration, where we really, really get to celebrate the local impacts and the local leaders who make the real difference in this country. So thank you for traveling all this way, especially on a Friday before a holiday weekend, for us to really celebrate the heroes of this country, which are the local leaders and our champions of change. Thank you and enjoy today.
Thank you, Christy, for those great marks. I'd like to welcome now Deputy Secretary of Commerce, Bruce Andrews.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. And before I begin, I want to thank both the White House Council on Environmental Quality and also our team at NOAA for planning today's event. I also want to thank all of you for being here. Today, we recognize a group of men and women for their service as champions of change. While I won't be able to join you for the entire event, I really want to be here today to personally say how important your efforts are to our communities, our country, and our planet. Every day, ordinary Americans do extraordinary things. They are not motivated by fame or fortune. Instead, they are driven by the idea of making things better for their families, friends, and neighbors. That is what Champions of Change is all about. It's a chance to recognize those making a difference in their communities. It's a chance to celebrate people like you. Fishing is one of our nation's oldest and proudest professions. Every morning before the sun rises, thousands of Americans head out to sea to fish. And back on shore, there are entire industries that support this important commercial and recreational activity. Later on, others deliver fresh seafood to the stores where we shop and the restaurants where we eat. And in full disclosure, I have to admit I really like seafood, so thank you. But for each of you who contribute to the sustainability of our nation's fisheries, your work is building stronger communities and a stronger economy. Your actions will have a lasting impact that will span several decades. Each of you has contributed to the ongoing recovery of America's fishing industry and the resilience of our coastal communities. The recreational and commercial fishermen here today and the communities they support have each made business sacrifices to help U.S. fisheries to rebuild. And each of you we honor today has worked to ensure this industry remains a source of food and enjoyment for millions of people, continues to create jobs for our workers, and innovates to meet the challenges of the 21st century. Yet I find it fitting that we celebrate these achievements during the 40th anniversary of Magnuson-Stevens. The MSA laid the foundation for a thriving American seafood industry, as well as recreational fishing and tourism sectors, which are the backbone of coastal economies. It has driven both economic and environmental change and success. After decades of decline, we are witnessing the economic and ecological resurgence of America's fishing industry. By preventing overfishing and rebuilding stocks, we are strengthening the financial value of fisheries while also ensuring that marine ecosystems can provide a sustainable supply of seafood into the future. Today, overfishing is at an all-time low, as many stocks have been returned to sustainable levels. Meanwhile, the U.S. fishing industry contributed nearly $200 billion to the American economy in 2014, and almost 2 million jobs. You are proving that we can protect our environment and create good-paying jobs at the same time. But we know that this turnaround did not happen overnight. It took constant collaboration between government and this industry. None of our past progress would have been possible without a firm commitment to sustainable practices by fishermen, suppliers, and local leaders. President Obama and this administration want to ensure America's fishermen and our coastal communities continue to thrive in the 21st century. At the Department of Commerce and through the work of NOAA, we are committed to the continued success of the industry in global markets. To do this, we must provide a level playing field so that American fishermen committed to sustainable fisheries can successfully compete on the international market. That is why we are combating IUU fishing, both here at home and with our international partners. The reason for our commitment is simple. IUU fishing is unfair for individuals like you who abide by the law and create healthy fisheries for our future. Management measures must be enforced and circumventing conservation efforts must be stopped. I know that many of you in the room are likely hoping that I will share some news about our seafood import traceability rule. All I can say at this moment is it is a top priority for the Department of Commerce. We expect to publish the final rule and the National Standard One rule in the near future. We all want to guarantee a safe and sustainable supply of seafood. You, the champions of change, have each improved the way we fish today. But you are also dedicated to ensuring the opportunity to fish continues for generations to come. We share the vision and commitment at the Department of Commerce. This is why I hope you will consider us as a resource. We want to help you transform these innovative ideas from our champions into common business practices. Our work is far from complete, but together we will continue to build sustainable fisheries, healthy habitats, and resilient communities. Good luck with the program today, and thank you for being here.
Thank you, Bruce. Thanks for setting the hook. So I'd like to welcome our first panel. So Alan Lovewell, Byron Inclade, Christopher Brown, Jason Dela Cruz, Linda Bacon, and Luca Mossman, please come up. And the moderator will be Ellen Bolin from the National Oceanic Atmospheric Administration.
Thank you all for coming today. I want to echo the comments of the Deputy Secretary and Christy for talking about the excellent change and the champions that we have here. I've actually had the privilege of meeting a lot of the men and women that we're speaking to today in their regions and seeing them on the water and at management council meetings, which are tedious but very necessary, and seeing their commitment and their dedication to both the process through the sacrifices and the successes that we've had. And so it's going to be a great opportunity to hear more about what they've been able to do. So why don't we quickly go down and introduce yourself and just provide a quick bit about kind of who you are and where you're from.
Hello, everybody. My name is Christopher Brown. I am the president of the Rhode Island Commercial Fishermen's Association, and I am also the president of the Seafood Harvesters of America. I am an active commercial fisherman. I fished a couple of days ago. I'll be fishing tomorrow about 2 o'clock in the afternoon. And, I've been fishing for so long, I've seen this industry at its best in New England, and unfortunately I've seen it at its worst. We have taken some hard hits to turn things around. I think we are most of the way through the turn. I get to come here and talk to you about this stuff, and it is by virtue of the fact that I stand before a huge bunch of fishermen who have some enormously wonderful core values. That is why I am here. It is not so much me. I think it is always the people that you represent that lead you to a place like this. So I'd like to accept any accolades on their behalf. So I'll turn it over.
Hello, my name is Alan Lovewell. Before I start, I just want to thank everyone. It's obviously been a tremendous effort to get everyone here, and obviously we all represent a lot of individuals back home that have put in a tremendous amount of effort to make our dreams and our visions reality, so without them it's obviously not possible. So I come from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts. And I grew up in a very unique place where I knew my fishermen, I knew where my seafood was coming from. The bycatch of the fishermen I knew would actually end up being my dinner. And I moved out to Santa Cruz, California, and I've traveled around the world, and I've realized that my experience where I grew up was very unique. In fact, most people don't know their fishermen. They don't know where their fish comes from, and it's a big problem. It's one of the leading reasons why we have IUU. If we knew the conditions at which our seafood was being produced, we probably wouldn't buy a lot of it. And so what I decided to do and why I'm here is because, you know, come up with a solution, a unique solution, where we're at, again, connecting fishermen to the consumer, not just for consumer trust and knowing where their food is coming from, but on the fisherman's side of things, knowing where their fish is going. And I think that's a really valuable thing that we don't often discuss. Fishermen like to know where their fish is going just as much as we like to know where we're getting it from. And then also realizing that seafood isn't just about, and local seafood isn't just a right or something for the elite. And we shouldn't just have to get it out of Whole Foods or large grocery stores at a premium price, that it should be accessible to all. It's a commons resource. It comes from the ocean. No one owns the ocean, or at least all of it. We obviously have our EEZs, but the idea that, you know, we should all, as citizens, you know, of this country and other countries, should be able to access seafood in different ways, and getting seafood to children in schools, I think, is a great way, one, to improve the nutritional value of foods being served to these children, but get them connected, get them, you know, excited about the ocean, get them excited about maybe becoming a fisherman one day. And right now, those opportunities are again slim. So, putting together those building blocks is, I think, fundamental for having a sustainable future.
Hi, everyone. My name is Byron Anglard. I'm the president of Louisiana Oysterman Association, and I also serve on the Oyster Task Force for the state of Louisiana, and serve on many other seafood boards such as GoFish. Louisiana, of course, is met with many challenges. We're not going to talk about global warming and erosion. We all know it's happening. Nowhere more evident of the consequences are being felt in Louisiana. And of course, man-made and natural events. We find ourselves losing out on oysters. We were probably the largest producer of oysters in the United States, and we're losing that battle. Our coast is eroding, and Louisiana is unique because our seafood industry, such as oysters, our mussels, it's tied to coastal erosion, and the science have proven that. And that's one of the challenges I've always had, was, you know, getting people to understand and pay attention to the science. Because I do believe if we're going to change the course and change the attitude and the mindset of the fishermen and those that benefits from it, we have to pay attention to the science. And my job has been making sure we have the policy and that allows the science to move, for us to move forward and benefit from our science community. So thank you, and I'm grateful to be here.
Aloha mai kako. My name is Luca Mossman, and I'm from Hilo, Hawaii. I grew up, I'm not a president of anything. I'm so honored to be here around accomplished people. I'm just a lowly, I work for Conservation International as a project coordinator, but I'm first and foremost a Native Hawaiian, and I'm also a fish pond practitioner, and I'm here, like everyone else, to represent those people that I work with on the ground. In Hawaii, in ancient Hawaii, there was over 400 fish ponds across of the state of Hawaii. Now there's less than 50 being managed and being restored. But it's exciting to see more and more people on these fish ponds, seeing that our fishery in Hawaii is everything to us. You know, when those boats stop coming in and stop bringing food, we depend everything on the ocean. And the fish ponds help us not only perpetuate a culture moving forward, but it also helps produce fish and provide fish for our communities. It's a very old system, but it's also very innovative moving forward into the future. And my whole job is to help support those people that work on these fish ponds so that they can have a sustainable livelihood and also promote this practice to the younger generations so that they can grow up to be these fish pond managers and see these fish ponds be more productive. The fish pond that I grew up restoring in Kalehaleolono in Hilo, Hawaii, is over 800 years old, and it's still working today, and it's still feeding the children, the Native Hawaiian children that live around it. And so it's exciting to see more and more fish ponds being managed. It's kind of the in thing now in Hawaii, and so I'm really stoked. I'm really honored to be here and learn from you, learn from everybody on this table and sitting in the stands. I really look up to these champions that are working to protect our oceans, to protect our food. We're talking about it last night. Is food is culture, and if you don't respect your food, you don't respect your culture. And so that's what our people and our fish pond practitioners really thrive at. Because we all love eating fish, and we want to continue eating fish. So that's why we have these fish ponds. That's why we're all here. Mahalo.
Linda Benkin. I'm from Sitka, Alaska, commercial fisherman for over 30 years, everywhere from Southeast Alaska to the Bering Sea, and no, it's nothing like Deadliest Catch. I am the executive director of Alaska Longline Fishermen's Association and feel, as others have said, that really any success I have is due to the incredible people, fishermen that I work with, and both at Alpha and in various coalitions, networks that I'm also involved with. I have found fishermen to be incredible problem solvers. They have to be. When you're out on the water 90 miles offshore and something breaks, you have to know how to fix it, and you have to know how to get yourself back to shore and keep your crew safe. So we've tried to harness that creativity by working with our fishermen, involving them in research projects with scientists, with academia, with NGOs, with the federal government, state government, to solve the problems that we see, that other agencies see, and be creative about how you enable fishing to continue while taking care of the fish and understanding better the forces that are happening in the ocean. We've also tried to use those same connections to help young people come into the fisheries. So having people who are established, that know how to avoid sensitive habitat, know how to avoid bycatch hotspots, mentor young fishermen, share data with young fishermen, and help them be successful with running their businesses in ways that also sustain the fisheries for the future. Like Alan, we have a CSF to try and connect people, try and tell the stories of the people in the fisheries, of their successes, of their commitment to sustainable fisheries for the future. I'm really excited to be here, really honored to be part of this group, and really look forward to hearing from everybody who's part of this process.
Thank you very much for this opportunity to be here, and I'll be honest, it's a very humbling experience. Jason Dela Cruz, I've been a commercial spearfishing for about 15 years now, and I kind of grew up in the business from catching bait to supplying it to the little boats when I was, 10 years old to 12 years old, all through those summers, and then kind of just evolved into the fishing industry. It really is something that I truly love. Being in the water as I do as often as I am, it's something I even, seems like the older I get, the more I appreciate just looking at what's below me and less worrying about harvest, which I think is kind of an evolution of things. I am the vice president of the Gulf of Mexico Reef Fish Shareholders Alliance and then the executive director of Gulf Wild. We were one of the first people to decide to actually build a traceability and a brand out of our fish in the Gulf of Mexico. We focused in the reef fishery, which is less of a coastal community and more of a kind of a regional area. So when we built the brand, we built it with that mindset so that we could identify our product all the way through the supply chain. In doing so, We learned a lot of interesting things about it, and it kind of made us interesting stewards of the environment from a standpoint is we saw that it gave us an opportunity to put ourselves on a level playing field with other premium products and maintain value to the boats so the guys could make truly good money in doing so. One of the other parts about what I love what we do, and about 5 years ago I started a seafood company behind the idea of this brand could be successful. And in doing so, I get a chance to spend every day on the dock talking with captains that fish for me and having these conversations with deckhands about what the differences that we can actually make at the deck level. And that's one of the things that we've always believed at Gulf Wild is that the fundamental sustainability sometimes really has to start at the deck level. And if I can teach these guys what the value of it is and then make sacrifices in my company by paying them more money for bycatch than they can pay for bait, then that drives them to actually land those fish. We get to keep track of them and see how to really make, you know, sustainability work throughout the supply chain. And fortunately, the brand also gave us the opportunity to partner with people that see value in what we're doing and the way we do it to actually continue to foster that and maintain a fishery. We went through some challenges like everybody else with some recent, you know, regulatory change in 2010. And in doing so, it was a big learning curve for everybody. Unfortunately, I've been in the thick of that since that happened, and being able to foster that with the guys that fish with me and actually even with the people that work at my fish house. You know, we're a small place. We're only, you know, 10 people, and they really are the core crew. You know, I get opportunity to educate them. They educate fishermen. It's a big trickle-down effect. We really, really am proud of what we get to do.
Thank you. One of the common themes I heard many of you talk about was this sense of passing on fishing to a future generation. So I think, Linda, you said kind of fisheries for the future. And Linda, in particular, you've done a lot of work helping young people come into the fishery. And I wondered if you could expand on that and talk about both some of the challenges you face and the successes. And I imagine a few of you others have thoughts on the next generation, so we can pass the question along. But I figure I'd start with you.
I would say the first thing we do, or our, you know, our biggest challenge, is taking care of the fish. And we start from that point in all different ways, whether it's advocacy or research, and see that as just critical to making sure there's fish for the future. But we also have a number of programs that are focused specifically on helping young fishermen enter the fisheries. We're working at the national level with a fishing community coalition to help start a young fishermen's development program that would support fishermen with training, education, hands-on kind of experience they need, similar to programs that are in place for young farmers, young ranchers. We have a small apprentice program that we're running out of Sitka that allows people from the community, sometimes even people who are there short-term as interns or as fellows working in the community, to get out on a commercial fishing boat to work for a week and gain some experience in what it's like to be on a boat, whether they go on because they're now experienced and can get that second job, or just so they take home that kind of understanding of what happens on the ocean. We also work to mentor young fishermen, new fishermen, into the business through a fishery conservation network that we've started, where our experienced fishermen are sharing data with the younger fishermen. We collect information from all our fishermen on habitat mapping, so bathymetric mapping. We compile that information and provide it back to people so that they can avoid sensitive areas, so that they can be more efficient in catching their target species while reducing their bycatch of sensitive species. We also flag for them through that areas that are bycatch hotspots for species such as rockfish that are long-lived and easy to overfish, so that new people coming in don't have to make the mistakes of fishing in the wrong area before they learn that that's an area to stay away from. And in the policy front, we look always for ways to protect the entry level, to make sure the cost of the entry level doesn't get any steeper than it is right now under catch year programs. That's often a challenge. And we've worked with partners at the Alaska Sustainable Fisheries Trust to launch a local fish fund that brings together young fishermen, people, whether they're fishermen or people who just care about the future of fisheries, to provide entry level through investment to the fisheries in ways that lowers that initial cost and lowers the initial risk of buying into the fishery. And we're building that as an opportunity to bring young people in. One of the stipulations of people coming into the fishery through that program is that we also involve them in our fishery conservation network. So they're contributing information, helping with research, and also gaining from the experience of others in how to fish cleanly and continue to improve best fishing practices.
Chris, fishing is a big part of the community in New England. As well, I know that your region has seen some changes, and as Christy mentioned, it's also facing some changes from a changing climate. Kind of how do you see the next generation adopting and adapting to fishing in New England, and what do you see are some of the hopes and successes?
Yeah, thank you. The next generation of fishermen's best hope is that we accept accountability as our savior in this generation. We have had a rough and rocky relationship with the scientific process. It is well documented. That is probably the only thing that's well documented in New England. until we can empower the science that determines abundance levels in New England, there isn't a whole lot of hope for the groundfish-dependent component of our fishery. It's frightening. The good news is there are more fish than are known. The bad news is we don't have access to them because we have such a poor relationship with the scientific process. You know, catch verification is a necessary component in our fishery. We do not have that. We do not know precisely what is being landed. We do not know precisely what is being discarded. In some cases, discard assumptions are infinitely higher than the reality that we have. So it's not a one-sided conversation. In short, if you can't measure it, you can't manage it. We're managing for the future. It's hugely important that we do not lose our horizons and our goals. You know, the average age of a fisherman in New England is about 58 years old. That's my age. And every time it goes down a number or two, it's because one of the really old guys tipped over. You know, we need to attract youth. We have a responsibility to bring stocks back to where they were when we started. The responsible utility of our nation's resources is an expression of patriotism. Fishermen in this country are good Americans. We need to get our act together. We need to force ourselves to bring change upon our fishery and bring opportunity to the next generation of people waiting in line.
Thanks. Byron, you talked about the fact that your region has undergone a lot of change. I know that you've done a lot of work with the communities after Deepwater Horizon and the challenge that posed to the region. I think the unique thing about oysters is they're both a source of food for the community as well as a critical part of coastal restoration. And I didn't know if you could talk a little bit more about some of the work you're doing with the communities in that region.
Well, Chris mentioned something in his statement. Louisiana, we've done a remarkable job of accountability. We could tell you what time, what day our oysters, where they were caught, and where they went. And all of we trace them from the water all the way to the consumer. And it also gives us a very good idea where we're producing, where we're falling off. And if we don't know where these oyster reefs are and where they're being depleted at, then you can't have an effective management program. And you'll find a lot of times where the oysters were and not now, that's where you see your largest sign of coastal erosion. So, and that's when we're talking about bringing our science community in. We were warned about these things by our science community, but we didn't pay attention. And unfortunately, there were always the voices behind the political movement. We've got to change that in Louisiana. we've got to put our knowledge in front of the political movements. And as and I find as we bring our oyster industry back, we're going to find we're going to have a big weapon on coastal erosion. And I'd like to say this, as a young fisherman growing up, we had oyster reefs on the east bank of Plaquemine Parish off of California Point. You couldn't even bring a boat into there except with a navigational genius. I could remember an instance where we had an incident where the Coast Guard was sitting outside in Black Bay, and he had to get in to get to this boat. And he said, well, I got good water. I got all this navigational equipment on there. My little brother, who has a third grade education, he said, you're not going to get in there. And his challenge was to get in there. After about four or five times, he finally said, could you bring me in there? He said, sure, I'll bring you in there. That's why I'm sitting there. So he navigated him through these oyster reefs. He had no idea these reefs was there. So those oyster reefs control tidal surge. When you have them there, you know, it slows that water down. It allows that sediment to fall out. This is one of the arguments I have with not having the right policy in front of the science or to support the science. The Mississippi River is one of the largest sediment transfer in the world. Why haven't we seen land down there? But yet when the Mississippi River overflowed its banks and it steady built those oyster reefs, and those reefs slowed down that tidal, gave that time for that sediment to fall out of that water, and that's what helped build our coast. I believe that. And I think if we look at the science, we could have both sustainable seafood and protection for our coast. And those mussel fish provide not only just that, it's so many things, purifying the water, you know. So that's I hope I've answered the question. So, but anyway, that's where we stand, and that's why I'm so worked on policy. And we've changed some of the equipment. Right now, I just got a bill through legislation. It took me 15 years to do so. It's called lifting the moratorium. And you can't do things when you have a law sitting there saying you can't touch none of these oyster reefs, you can't move them, you can't do anything with them, and we don't want to move. So we have to change our habits. We can't go out there and take 1,000 tons of shells and material every year when we only, Mother Nature is only producing 100. You know, so we've got to reverse those things, and that's a responsibility of the fishermen and our legislators. So I hope I've answered your question. Thank you.
That's very helpful. And as someone who likes oysters, I very much appreciate your work. I like all seafood, actually, so this is very helpful. Luca, actually, similar question to you. I know a lot of the work around fish ponds has broader impacts in the surrounding environment. I didn't know if you could talk a little bit more about some of those impacts.
Yeah, so our ancestors figured out a long time ago how productive estuaries can be when they see these brackish water environments and how productive the microorganisms are in there, and that attracts all kinds of different fish. So when they seen that, they said, "Oh, I can make an estuary," and so they developed these rock walls along the coastline. To not stop but slow the freshwater inputs into the ocean. So when you slow down that freshwater, and that gives it time for the freshwater and saltwater to mix and produce that microorganisms, and that's what attracts the fish, and that's what, you know, feeds the fish and have them grow rapidly and exponentially. And so when you have these booming systems along the coastline, they almost act as fads along the coast. And so you have all this activity inside the fish pond, and all of that activity attracts other ocean fish closer to the pond. So they not only benefit the people who manage those fish ponds, but they also benefit the fishermen that fish along that coast. And so we're not, for us on the that working that manage fish ponds, we let nature dictate how we work and how much we eat. As long as we keep the freshwater stream or the freshwater springs healthy, and we keep the fish pond healthy, you're going to have a lot of fish. But if it's not healthy, you know, the amount of fish that you harvest from those ponds greatly decline. And so it's not only benefiting to us, but it just benefits the whole coastline. And so that's why we do what we do.
Thanks. And I think Luca and Linda might be tied for the people that flew the farthest to come here. I was trying to figure out geography, but you guys can have to figure that out at the end. Alan and Jason, both of you all mentioned kind of this need or this sort of approach to being able to trace the fish from where you bring it in from the dock to where it goes to on the plate. Jason, you've done a lot of work with Gulf Wild. Your fish has been served at events in D.C. Alan, your fish is reaching school kids, which is a pretty finicky audience at times. Can you either one of you talk about how traceability has changed, kind of how you approach your business and how you approach what you think of as a future for the fishery? Jason or Alan, and then the other.
I think the main thing for us as we've been thinking about traceability is that it doesn't need to be some sort of, expectation or something that's managerial, though that's kind of the reason why traceability exists in the food system. Mostly is for managing risk. It's for understanding, you know, foodborne illnesses. It's for understanding, you know, the quality and controlling quality. But what we found is actually traceability for us is really more about telling a story. It's about engaging an audience and our customers, the school kids, the individuals and families that receive our fish, and getting them excited about where their fish is coming from, right? There's context, and I think that's for us what excites us about traceability. It's not so much the back end side of things, again, in sort of managing your supply chain, which I think, you know, Jason will speak a lot more to. For us, it's more about an educational tool, an awareness tool, getting people excited to know where the fish is coming from, to know that it's not something that's generic. It's not just a generic piece of protein on your plate. There's a really amazing story behind it. And as you all know, the ocean is the source for all kinds of amazing stories. It continues to provide so much wonder in our lives. As it said, you know, we know more about space than we do the ocean. And I think we can see that as a bad thing, or we can say, you know, that's a source for mystery. It's a source for curiosity. It's a source for us getting excited and knowing that, you know, every time a fish comes up from the depths, you know, there's something magical there. And to get that on your plate, to know where it came from, to know the weather, to know the climate, to know the changes in our environment right now, to understand, you know, that there is warming, that there's acidification, that there's, in our coastline, we've got, you know, the warm blob, and what does that mean for fish, right? And to relate that back to what's on your plate, you know, and say, hey, look, there's warmer waters now, which means we're getting fish that we haven't seen before, and we can get people excited about that. Like, here's bonita that we don't see very often. We have bluefin tuna that have been showing up. That is something very new in our waters, and we can get people excited about that.
So for us, the traceability aspect actually was born out of that little oil spill we had. Because all of our species are offshore, we kind of saw it as a survival tactic. We had some friends that were willing to help us develop the brand and the traceability, and we actually narrowed it all the way down to buy a 10x10 grid so we could prove to people where the fish were coming from. But the other thing that I think really rose out of it is similar, the story. The story was the marketing, the cool marketing catch, but what we really realized is it was an empowerment tool. The consumer wants to know that they're sourcing sustainable fish, but because the species that we deal with were very expensive, there's a lot of pressure from imports to lower the price on that. And that wasn't necessarily the big challenge, but the challenge was that people wanted to know that they were sourcing a domestic product that was that was truly sustainable, and there was no real way to identify us separately from the imported product, and this gave us that tool to do that. So the empowerment tool that you were giving the consumer by them buying a fish with a tag on it that showed the name of the captain and where it was caught in the fish house, and then the steps along the way that it gave them was really the key to really let them make their choices and make sustainability something that they can provably say that they're doing, not just, you know, assume. So we kind of started for one reason and then evolved it into a tool that really gave clarity to it. And he is right. We have used it very fortunately through the process and learned really neat things about it. We can identify problem areas even in individual boats by using the location of where the fish come from and stuff like that. So that's been incredibly helpful. But the empowerment of the consumer has really been the biggest trick that we've come up with and truly traceable product and identifying the product.
Great, thanks. I've also heard a couple of you mention the fact that you are seeing changes on the water. We're seeing some fish move north. I've heard stories about what people are seeing in the Gulf of Maine. I know it's a concern in Alaska and other areas. And so I'll just open up the question to the panel of what do you see as some of the challenges from a changing environment, as well as some of the possible opportunities in terms of how you approach fisheries management and what does it look like? Chris.
Yeah, one of the problems with climate change and the industry's survival is our permitting structure. You know, I'm permitted to catch fish that I caught over the course of the last 30 or 40 years because they are indigenous to my neck of the woods. They are readily available, and it's fine until they don't live there anymore and they live somewhere else. And the fish that now live in my backyard, I don't have permits for. We have an incredibly rigid structure around our permits. There is no consideration for stock shift, and I just don't know how we're going to get through it. It's a really, if you want to start a fight with somebody, start talking about reallocating based on climate change. It's a good way to just not,
we'll look at that as time, you know, to go. No.
Yeah. Yeah. But it's a real threat. You know, one of the conditions of a food web that is out of whack, or one that is functioning in a stress condition, is that it from time to time produces enormous year classes of specific species. You have these huge sine waves of abundance that roll across the screen. In New England, we have haddock. We have scallops. We have lobsters. There's always something that is in tremendous natural abundance. Whether or not it's a healthy scenario or not is debatable. But then you have a lot of the people who live there who didn't fish for scallops, didn't fish for lobsters, didn't fish for haddock, and they are permitted to sit and watch their friends make a lot of money. You know, any definition of a sustainable fishery going forward will include your ability to survive economically in any environmental situation that is presented to you. This nation is bettered by more people surviving in the fishery than fewer. We need to have the ability to talk about changing the way we permit vessels. We need to be able to consider sharing the upper reaches of abundance on these stocks with people who currently do not have them in their permitting portfolio. That way, when their stock flourishes and the other guy's stock tanks, we don't lose another layer of fishermen. You know, in New England, we say that the sun don't shine on the same dog's butt too many days in a row. And this is a classic example of what happens when, you know, the ecosystem goes crazy, you don't have permits, you get rich people one day, and then the next day they're poor. By virtue of them just being in the fishery long enough, their stock is going to come and go. And we have to start thinking about what keeps boats in business and not really what makes a few guys really, really wealthy. I'm not opposed to wealthy guys, but I like to see a lot of boats in the harbor. Our systems, our economic systems in the harbors cease to function properly below a certain threshold. You know, you end up having one person that delivers oil instead of three. You have one ice company that has ice instead of four. You have one dealer instead of five. It's always better to have more. Our economy is dependent on everybody doing all right, and we have to find ways to reconsider the distribution of some of the higher stocks and the value of that will make itself abundantly clear when the people who are giving today will be receiving tomorrow.
Thank you. Linda, and then Luca.
Thank you. Yeah, I would definitely agree that the permitting process is making it difficult as stocks move, and fishermen are feeling locked in to what they can fish for and where they can fish for, and it's difficult for fishermen now to move between fishery because that cost of entry tends to be high. I think it's also going to be really important to be prepared to manage and protect species that show up in new areas and start to be exploited in a place where there isn't a structure in place to be careful that those fish aren't overfished. I think the other thing Chris said that really resonates with me in helping fishermen survive through climate change and the challenges that we're going to face is to keep the eye on the ball of that more fishermen on the water, small businesses that are able to survive, are really important as opposed to allowing too much consolidation on our industry. It's important all the way from the entry level for future generations through the support sectors on land that thrive if you have a healthy fishing industry on the water. One of the ways that we see resilience built into the system where I live in Southeast Alaska is that some years ago we were able to close the area to large, in sort of industrial trawling. The fishermen, the communities in Southeast Alaska have always been small boats, primarily hook and line, pot, and that has been sustainable in that area for 100 years. So the council recognized that this is an area that can stay healthy by keeping it set up in this way. It's gear that's sustainable environmentally, socially, economically. And I think that's something we're going to have to think about as we move ahead with ocean management and with adapting to climate change and with thinking about what kind of fishing can happen in what areas in a sustainable way, and where we have to be really careful as fish stocks move and as fisheries change.
Thank you. I think, Luca, I think you're going to get the last word.
Sure. for us at the who live on islands in the Pacific, climate change is very evident to us. Especially a lot of our brothers and sisters down south in the South Pacific are losing their homes and are losing their islands, and they have to change their entire livelihoods and move to other places that are still above water. Our fish ponds, for us in Hawaii, our fish ponds are the first indicator of climate change, of sea level rise especially. Our walls that sit right along our dry stack, what we call, sits right on top of the coastline. And just this year alone, we've seen tides that we've never seen before. Tides are about a foot higher than they were, a year ago. And that's not going to change. It's going to consistently get higher and higher. And so our practices, our ancient fish ponds are in danger. But as long as we still have this practice, as long as we continue to teach the next generation how productive fish ponds are and how to create them and how to manage fish ponds sustainably, our fishery is going to be okay. But we have to be observant of our resources, of these new changes in our ecosystem, so that our people stay resilient. Thank you.
Thank you. So thank you all for your time and for sharing with us your stories and also some of the challenges that you continue to face, and really looking forward to hearing about what you all do next and the changes you continue to make in your communities. I think I will turn it back over to Whit.
Just want to say thanks again to our first panel. That was really powerful, and I really liked, was really inspired, I think, by a lot of the theme of narrative that came out of the idea of traceability as narrative of fishing and how fishing is changing in the face of climate. I think that's a powerful lens to look at sustainability through. So We're going to have a couple of speakers now between this panel and the next, so I just would like to welcome Dr. Jane Lomachenko up for some brief remarks about climate and resilience.
Hi, everybody. I am so excited to be here today. This is really a fabulous, fabulous opportunity to celebrate champions of change. In my very short remarks today, what I want to do is just offer a few reflections teeing off President Obama's theme of resilience during the Our Ocean Conference of a few weeks ago. The ocean, as most of you know, and that I've learned from a lifetime of studying marine ecosystems, the ocean is resilient. When given half a chance to recover before it's too late, the ocean can in fact rebound. It can adapt, regenerate, and return to health. America, too, is resilient. And the fishermen that I have had the opportunity to know and work with over the years are most definitely resilient. They are among the most resilient members of our community. And the hard truth is that they have needed to be resilient. And I'm not just talking about resilience in the face of a great big huge storm on the open ocean, but indeed resilience in the face of seeing everything that you've worked for as a fisherman, dependent on the healthy ocean, come crashing down before you. I can only imagine how our Ocean Oregon champion, Brad Pettinger, must have felt back in 2000 when after years of failing management, the Pacific groundfish fishery was declared a fishery federal disaster. Or how Jason De La Cruz must have felt with the Gulf Red Snapper stocks at a fraction of healthy levels. But there was no way that they would give up. And given half a chance, with the emergence of new ideas about how we can better manage fisheries, they gave everything they had to moving forward and making change happen. Chris Brown didn't just complain when he saw people in power doing things that he disagreed with. He helped organize a mighty band of fellow fishermen from around the country under a national umbrella to put things right. Bun Lai didn't just accept the rising tide of invasive species, he set about putting them to delicious use. And indeed, today, each of our champions of change have shown a power of resilience and a power of innovation and adaptation that make us very, very proud. They've shown bold leadership in the face of adversity. They give us profound hope for the future of our ocean. Make no mistake, we know that when we manage fisheries for the benefit of both fishermen and fish, we can truly have a win-win outcome. The dramatic turnaround of U.S. fisheries is perhaps the greatest unappreciated environmental success story of the decade. The fraction of overfished stocks has been slashed by a third, and even more impressive, there has been a nearly tenfold increase in the number of recovered stocks during this administration. So I'm here to say thank you to our champions of change and all of the other people that they represent. Thank you. We should be forever grateful to the fishermen, the chefs, the advocates, the scientists, and many others whose valiant work has made this turnaround possible. I am hopeful and I am proud today. Congratulations to all of our champions.
Thank you, Jane. Sentiments I know we all share. Now I'd like to welcome National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration Administrator, Dr. Kathy Sullivan.
Thank you, Whit. I want to echo Christy and Bruce's initial welcome to the White House, to all of our champions and to our guests, and certainly echo Jane's words of appreciation and pride for all the accomplishments, personal characteristics, personal commitment, and dedication that all of the people we are celebrating here today represent. I really appreciated also the candid perspectives and the insights that our first panel offered. You just can't beat hearing directly from people that are living these challenges, but also living this progress out on the water, in the docks, even in the halls of finance and marketplaces, as Monica is. The impact of each of our champions, though, in many cases, as you've heard, they work at a local level, the impact of each one of them is well beyond that local scale. And I think that also came through in the first panel. The tie and the linkages that each of our champs represents, the perspective they all have, which I'm always impressed by when I walk the docks or walk the deck plates, the fisherman, the processor, the chef, the awareness of the ocean, the awareness of ecosystem health and vitality, the awareness of habitats, and the awareness of global markets and how those affect the livelihoods that they are creating in the communities they live in. It's always just tremendously impressive. So we've made a lot of progress, as has been said, and as our first panel of champions has shown. We're also making progress, as Secretary Andrews mentioned, on illegal, unreported, and unregulated fishing, because all of the folks we're celebrating here today and everyone else through our fishing communities deserves to be working on a level playing field, where the folks they're competing with and working with are also abiding by good rules of sustainability and sound practice. Here in the United States, those standards, the standards of accountability that our panelists mentioned of sustainability, of habitat, and of healthy shoreside and fishing economies, those standards are maintained under the framework of the Magnuson-Stevens Act. And as Bruce Andrews mentioned, it's really delightful and fitting that we're celebrating this year the 40th anniversary of that landmark statute. This administration, from its inception, but in particular in this anniversary year, has reaffirmed a commitment to the strong, accountable, and science-based management system that is established under Magnuson. We've expanded maritime boundaries, we've established solid national standards, we've kept local decisions in the hands of those who know their waters and their communities best. And as Jane pointed out with the statistics that she cited, this framework, this commitment, has us very solidly on a pathway to ending overfishing completely in U.S. fish stocks, to recovering U.S. fish stocks, and in fact, to being a model that is now held up to great regard around the entire world. Atlantic scallop alone, which our New England friends will tell you not many decades ago was just about in the tank and not anything of value, is today a $400 million per year, quite sustainable fisheries. The fish caught domestically, the amount of catch has risen 23%. Over the course of this administration, and the value of that catch is up more than a third. And in that same period, we've grown the number of jobs across the commercial and recreational fishing sector by 35%. That's in sizable part as well due to the kind of great efforts that Linda and Luca and others are bringing to bring people in at young ages to the commercial fisheries, to the wild-caught fisheries, to aquaculture, and to fish ponds. But we all know that it ultimately takes more than a policy framework, more than rules on pieces of paper, and more than meetings around conference tables to create and drive us towards a really sustainable system. In this next panel, we'll celebrate the commitments of individuals who are exploring new methods to grow the sustainability of our fisheries beyond the water's edge, from the plate towards the dock. Our next round of champions are developing new practices and alternative technologies in producing seafood. In the face of growing global populations and stagnant landings, one of our champions has been a leader in the aquaculture movement. You'll hear from Kevin Maine. NOAA believes that aquaculture can become both a very sustainable and productive complement to wild capture fisheries. And it's a well-known fact that the United States represents one of the sweet spots of best prospect for growth in aquaculture. When there's more of a species than the market demands, some of our champions are developing initiatives to change that status quo as well. They're putting invasive species in four-star restaurants, as Bun Lai will talk to us about. And they're supplying school lunchrooms with nutritious but previously overlooked species. Alan will be back up to share some more comments. And these individuals are also creating new opportunities for our fishing communities. They're ensuring that the voice and the expertise of those on the water is heard in decision-making, as Robin Alden is doing. And they're connecting those individuals with new investors who can help support new entrants to the fisheries and new sustainable practices, as Monica will talk to us about. With each of these efforts, we take another positive step towards preserving the health of the ocean and promoting a more vibrant and productive fishing enterprise across our communities.